If a man is an agnostic or a materialist, his disbelief in a future life does not in the least prevent him from experiencing astral or mental life just the same as anyone else, for a man's disbelief in a future existence clearly cannot alter facts in nature. If a man has lived an unselfish life, the forces which he has generated must work themselves out, and this can take place only on the mental plane, i.e., in Devachan. There is, of course, no fatigue in Devachan, it is only the physical body that ever becomes tired. When we speak of mental fatigue, it is the brain and not the mind that is tired. The fact that our minds can grasp three dimensions only, whereas there are four dimensions on the astral plane, and five on the mental plane, makes it difficult to describe exactly the position in space of those who have left physical life. Some tend to hover around their earthly homes, in order to keep in touch with their friends of the physical life and the places which they know. Others, on the other hand, have a tendency to float away and to find for themselves, as if by specific gravity, a level much further removed from the surface of the earth. Thus, for example, the average person passing into heaven life tends to float to a considerable distance above the surface of the earth, although on the other hand, some of such people are drawn to our level. Still, broadly speaking, the inhabitants of the heaven world may be thought of as living in a sphere or zone round the earth. For all but very highly advanced persons, the heaven life is absolutely necessary, because it is only under its conditions that aspirations can be developed into faculty, and experiences into wisdom. The progress which is thus made by the soul is far greater than would be possible if by some miracle the man was enabled to remain in physical incarnation for the entire period. But for the advanced man who is making rapid progress, it is sometimes possible to give up the life of bliss in the heaven world to renounce Devachan, as it is sometimes called, between two incarnations, in order to return more rapidly to carry on work on the physical plane. But no man is permitted to renounce blindly that of which he is ignorant, nor to depart from the ordinary course of evolution unless and until it is certain that such a departure will be for his ultimate benefit. The general rule is that no one may renounce Devachan until he has experienced it during earth life, i.e., until he is sufficiently developed to be able to raise his consciousness to that plane and bring back with him a clear and full memory of its glory. The reason for this is that it is the life of the personality, with all its familiar personal surroundings, which is carried on in the lower heaven worlds, and therefore, before the renunciation can take place, the personality must realize clearly what it is that is being given up. The lower mind must be in accord with the higher on this subject. To this general rule there is an apparent exception. In the one-sided and artificial condition which we call modern civilization, people do not always develop quite regularly and normally. Cases are to be found in which a considerable amount of consciousness on the mental plane has been acquired, and duly linked onto the astral life, yet no knowledge of it ever gets through into the physical brain at all. Such cases are very rare, though they undoubtedly exist. They are not, however, exceptions to the principle embodied in the general rule, viz., that the personality must make the renunciation. For in these cases, the astral life would be one of full and perfect consciousness for the personality, even though no memory of it ever penetrated into the purely physical consciousness. Thus the renunciation is made by the personality, but through the astral consciousness instead of through the physical, as in most instances. Such cases would be unlikely to occur except among those who were at least probationary pupils of a master. A man who wishes to perform the great feat of renouncing Devachan must work with intense earnestness to make himself a worthy instrument in the hands of those who help the world, and must throw himself with devoted fervor into labor for the spiritual good of others. A man sufficiently advanced to be permitted to renounce his Devachan would clearly have enjoyed an extremely long heaven life. He is then able to expend this reserve of force in quite another direction, for the benefit of humanity, thus taking a part, however small, in the work of the Nirmanakas. When a pupil has decided to do this, he waits upon the astral plane until a suitable incarnation can be arranged for him by his master. Before the attempt can be made, permission of a very high authority must be obtained. Even when this is granted, so strong is the force of natural law, that it is said the pupil must be careful to confine himself to the astral plane, lest if once, even for a moment, he touched the devachanic plane, he might be swept as by an irresistible current into the line of normal evolution again. In some cases, though these are rare, the man is enabled to take an adult body whose previous tenant has no further use for it, but naturally it is not often that a suitable body is available. An animal that has attained individualization, after his death on the physical and astral planes, has usually a very prolonged, though often somewhat dreamy life in the lower heaven world. His condition is sometimes called dozing consciousness, and is analogous to that of a man on the same level, though with far less mental activity. He is surrounded by his own thought images, even though he may be but dreamily conscious of them, and these will of course include images of his earth friends in their very best and most sympathetic moods. These images will of course awaken response from the egos of his friends in the usual way. The animal will remain in the condition described until in some future world he assumes the human form. Individualization, by means of which an animal rises to the human kingdom, is attained by association with men. The intelligence and affection of the animal being developed to the degree necessary by his close relationship with his human friend. But we have already dealt with this matter in Chapter 13. Chapter 13, The First Heaven, Seventh Subplane. Although, as we shall see presently, each of the four lower heavens has its own characteristic, it must not be supposed that a man divides his heaven life between the various levels, according to the characteristics which he may have developed. On the contrary, as was mentioned briefly before, a man awakens to consciousness in Devachan on that level which best corresponds to the degree of his development, and on that level he spends the whole of his life in the mental body. The reasons for this is that the higher level may always include the qualities of the lower, as well as those peculiar to itself, and when it does so its inhabitants almost invariably have these qualities in fuller measure than the souls on the lower level. The lowest heaven, that on the seventh subplane, has for its principal characteristic that of affection for family and friends. That affection must, of course, be unselfish, but it is usually somewhat narrow. It must not, however, be supposed that love is confined to the lowest heaven, but rather that this form of affection is the highest of which those who find themselves on the seventh level are capable. On the higher levels, love of a far nobler and grander type is to be found. It may be useful to describe a few typical examples of the inhabitants of the seventh subplane. One was that of a small tradesman, honest and respectable, but of no intellectual development or religious feeling. Although he had probably attended church regularly, religion had been to him a sort of dim cloud which he did not really understand, which had no connection with the business of everyday life, and which was never taken into account in deciding its problems. Whilst he had, therefore, no depth of devotion, he had nevertheless warm affection for his family. They were constantly in his mind, and he worked in his shop far more for them than for himself. His surroundings in Devachan would not be of a very rain type, but nevertheless he would be as intensely happy as he would be capable of being, and he would be developing unselfish characteristics which would be built into his soul as permanent qualities. Other typical cases were that of a man who had died while his only daughter was still young. In his Devachan she was always with him, and at her best, while he was continually weaving all sorts of beautiful pictures of her future. Another case was that of a young girl who was always absorbed in contemplating the manifold perfections of her father, and planning little surprises and fresh pleasures for him. Another was a Greek woman who was marvelously happy with her three children, one of them a beautiful boy, whom she delighted in imagining as the victor in the Olympic Games. A striking characteristic of this subplane for the last few centuries has been a very large number of Romans, Carthaginians, and Englishmen found there, this being due to the fact that among men of these nations the principal unselfish activity found its outlet through family affection. Comparatively few Hindus or Buddhists are on this subplane, because in their case real religious feeling usually enters more immediately into their daily lives, and consequently takes them to a higher level. Among the cases observed, there was an almost infinite variety, their different degrees of advancement being distinguishable by varying degrees of luminosity, while differences of color indicate the qualities which the persons had developed. Some were lovers who had died in the full strength of their affection, and so were always occupied with the one person they loved, to the entire exclusion of all others. Others there were who had been almost savages, yet who had had some touch of unselfish action. In all these cases, the only element in the activity of their personal lives which could have expressed itself on the mental plane, was affection. In most cases observed on this level, the thought images are very far from perfect, and consequently the egos of the friends concerned can express themselves but poorly through them. But even at the worst, as explained in a previous chapter, that expression is fuller and more satisfying than it ever was in physical life. For those on this lowest level of the heaven world there is not much material out of which faculty can be molded, and their life is but very slightly progressive. Their family affections will be nourished and a little widened, and they will be reborn with a somewhat improved emotional nature, with more tendency to recognize and respond to a higher level. Chapter 24 The Second Heaven, Sixth Subplane. The dominant characteristic of the sixth subplane of the heaven world may be described as anthropomorphic religious devotion. There appears to be some correspondence between this level of the heaven world and the second astral subplane, the difference being that on the astral there is invariably an element of selfishness, of bargaining, in the religious devotion, whereas in the heaven world the devotion is of course entirely free from any such taint. On the other hand, this phase of devotion, which consists essentially in the perpetual adoration of a personal deity, must be distinguished from those still higher forms which find their expression in performing some definite work for the deity's sake. A few examples will show these distinctions. A fairly large number of entities on this level are drawn from Oriental religions, only those being included whose devotion is pure, but comparatively unreasoning and unintelligent. Worshippers of Vishnu, and a few of Shiva, are found here, each wrapped up in a cocoon of his own thoughts, alone with his God, and oblivious of the rest of mankind except in so far as his affections may associate those whom he loved on earth with his adoration of his deity. A Vishnavite was observed wholly absorbed in the ecstatic worship of the very image of Vishnu to which he had made offerings during earth life. Women form a very large majority of the inhabitants of this subplane, and afford one of its most characteristic examples. Among others, there was a Hindu woman who had glorified her husband into a divine being, and who also thought of the child Krishna as playing with her own children, but while these latter were thoroughly human and real, the child Krishna was obviously nothing but the semblance of a blue wooden image galvanized into life. Krishna also appeared in her heaven as an effeminate young man playing a flute, but she was not in the least confused by this double manifestation. Another woman, a worshipper of Shiva, looked upon her husband as a manifestation of her God, so that the one seemed to be constantly changing into the other. Some Buddhists are also found on this level, but apparently only those less instructed ones who regard the Buddha rather as an object of adoration than as a great teacher. Many Christians are found here, an illiterate Roman Catholic peasant, for example, full of unintellectual devotion, or an earnest or sincere soldier of the Salvation Army. An Irish peasant was seen absorbed in the deepest adoration of the Virgin Mary, whom he imaged as standing on the moon, but holding out her hands and speaking to him. A medieval monk was observed in ecstatic contemplation of Christ crucified, and the intensity of his yearning love and pity was such that, as he watched the blood dropping from the wounds of the figure of his Christ, the stigmata reproduced themselves upon his own mental body. Another man thought of his Christ only as glorified on his throne, with the crystal sea before him, and all around a vast multitude of worshippers, among whom he himself stood with his wife and family. Although his affection for his relatives was very deep, yet his thoughts were more occupied in adoration of the Christ, though his conception of his deity was so material that he imaged him as constantly changing kaleidoscopically backwards and forwards between the form of a man and that of a lamb bearing the flag, as often represented in church windows. An interesting case was that of a Spanish nun who had died at about the age of 19. In her heaven she imagined herself accompanying the Christ in his life as recounted in the Gospels, and after his crucifixion taking care of the Virgin Mary. Her pictures of the scenery and costumes of Palestine were entirely inaccurate, the Savior and his disciples wearing the dress of Spanish peasants, while the hills round Jerusalem were mountains clothed with vineyards, and the olive trees were hung with grey Spanish moss. She thought of herself as eventually martyred for her faith and ascending into heaven, but yet only to live over and over again this life in which she so delighted. A child who had died at the age of 7 was occupied in reenacting in the heaven world the religious stories which his Irish nurse had told him. He loved to think of himself as playing with the infant Jesus, and helping him to make those clay sparrows which the power of the Christ is fabled to have brought to life and caused to fly. Even if a man is a materialist and agnostic, he will still have a heaven world, provided he had been capable of devotion. For deep unselfish family affection, as well as earnest philanthropic effort, are also great outpourings of energy, which must produce their result, and can produce it nowhere but on the mental plane. It will be seen that blind unreasoning devotion, of which examples have been given, does not at any time raise its votaries to any great spiritual heights, but of course they are entirely happy and fully satisfied, for they receive the highest which they are capable of appreciating. Nor is such a heaven life without a very good effect on their future career. For although no amount of mere devotion will ever develop intellect, yet it does produce an increased capacity for a higher form of devotion, and in most cases it leads also to purity of life. A person, therefore, who enjoys a heaven, such as has been described, is not likely to make rapid progress, yet he is at least guarded from many dangers, for it is improbable that in his next birth he will fall into any of the grosser sins, or be drawn away from his devotional aspirations into a merely worldly life of avarice, ambition, or dissipation. Nevertheless, a survey of the sixth subplane distinctly emphasizes the desirability of following the advice of St. Peter, add to your faith, virtue, and to virtue knowledge. Chapter 25. The third heaven, fifth subplane. The chief characteristic of this level of the heaven world may be described as devotion expressing itself in active work. It is especially the plane from the working out of great schemes and designs unrealized on earth, of great organizations inspired by religious devotion, and usually having for their object some philanthropic purpose. It must, however, be borne in mind that as we rise higher, greater complexity and variety are introduced, so that many variations and exceptions occur which do not so rapidly range themselves under the general heading for the plane as a whole. A typical case, somewhat above average, was that of a deeply religious man who was found carrying out a grand scheme, which he had himself devised, for the amelioration of the condition of the poorer classes. The scheme comprised amalgamation of businesses in order to effect economies, high wages, the provision of cottages and gardens, and profit sharing. He hoped that this demonstration of the practical side of Christianity would win many to his own faith, out of gratitude for the material benefits they had received. A somewhat similar case was that of an Indian prince who had tried to model his life and methods of government, while on earth, on the example of the divine hero King Rama. On earth many of his schemes has failed, but in his heaven life everything went well, Rama himself personally advising and directing the work, and receiving perpetual adoration from all his devoted subjects. A curious case of personal religious work was that of a nun, who had belonged to a working order. In her heaven, she was constantly occupied in feeding the hungry, healing the sick, clothing and helping the poor, the peculiarity of each case being that each person, to whom she administered, at once changed into the appearance of Christ, whom she then worshipped with fervent adoration. An instructive case was that of two intensely religious sisters, one of them a cripple, the other having devoted herself to tending her. On earth they had often discussed and planned the religious and philanthropic work they would carry out if they were able to do so. In the heaven world, each is the most prominent figure in the heaven of the other, the cripple being well and strong, while each thinks of the other as working with her in carrying out the unrealized wishes of her earth life. In these cases the only difference that death has made is to eliminate disease and suffering, and to render easy the work which before had been impossible. On this plane are found the higher type of sincere and devoted missionaries, engaged in the congenial occupation of converting multitudes of people to the particular religion which they advocated. There occur also on this plane some cases of devotees of art, who follow it for its own sake, or regard it as an offering to their deity, not thinking of its effect on their fellows. Artists who pursued art, for the sake of fame and self-gratification, would not of course find their way to this plane at all. On the other hand, those who regarded their faculty as a great power entrusted to them for the spiritual elevation of their fellows would reach a heaven even higher than the one we are now considering. As an example, mention may be made of a musician of very religious temperament who regarded all his labor of love simply as an offering to the Christ, knowing nothing of the magnificent display of sound and color which his compositions produced on the mental plane. His enthusiasm would not, of course, be wasted, for, without his knowledge, it brought joy and help to many, and its results would certainly be to give him increased devotion and greater musical capacity in his next birth. But without the still wider aspiration to help humanity, this kind of heaven life might repeat itself almost indefinitely. The student will perceive that the three lower heavens, on the seventh, sixth, and fifth sub-planes, are concerned with the working out of devotion to personalities, either to one's family and friends, or to a personal deity, rather than the wider devotion to humanity for its own sake, which, as we shall see, finds its expression on the next subplane. Chapter 26. The Fourth Heaven, Fourth Subplane. The fourth heaven, on the fourth subplane, is on the highest of the lower Rupa levels. Its activities are so varied that it is difficult to group them under a single characteristic. They may best be arranged into four main divisions: 1. Unselfish pursuit of spiritual knowledge, 2. High philosophic or scientific thought, 3. Literary or artistic ability, exercised unselfishly, 4. Service for the sake of service. A few examples of each of these classes will make them more readily comprehensible. 1. Unselfish pursuit of spiritual knowledge. Most of the inhabitants of this class are drawn from those religions in which the necessity of obtaining spiritual knowledge is recognized. Thus, of Buddhists, there are found here those more intelligent followers who looked upon the Buddha as a teacher, rather than as a being to be adored, and whose supreme aspiration was to sit at his feet and learn. In their heaven life their wish is fulfilled, for the thought image which they have made of the Buddha is no mere empty form, through it shines the wonderful wisdom, power and love of that greatest of earth's teachers. They are therefore acquiring fresh knowledge and wider views, the effect of which on their next life cannot but be most marked. They will not perhaps remember any individual facts, though when such facts are presented to them in a subsequent life, they will grasp them readily, and intuitively recognize their truth. Furthermore, the result of the teaching will be to build into the ego a strong tendency to take broader and more philosophical views on all such subjects. The effect of such a heaven life is to hasten considerably the evolution of the ego. Hence the enormous advantage gained by those who accepted the guidance of living and powerful teachers. A similar result, in lesser degree, accrues to a man who followed the teachings of a great and spiritual writer, and made of that writer an ideal figure. The ego of the writer will enter into the student's heaven life and, by virtue of his own developed power, vivify the mental image of himself, thus being able further to illuminate his written teachings. Many Hindus find their heaven on this level, as also a few of the more advanced Sufis and Parsis, and some of the early Gnostics. But, except for a few Sufis and Gnostics, neither Mohammedanism nor Christianity seems to raise its followers to this level. Some, however, who nominally follow these religions may be carried to this subplane by the presence in their character of qualities which do not depend upon the teachings peculiar to their own religion. Here are found also earnest students of occultism, who are not yet sufficiently advanced to be permitted to renounce their devachan, cp. 203. These include students of schools of occultism other than that which is best known to most members of the Theosophical Society. An interesting case was observed, where a person who had fallen into an attitude of unworthy and unjustifiable distrust of the motives of her old friend and teacher, had thereby shut out to a considerable extent the higher influence and teaching, which otherwise she might have enjoyed in her heaven life. The influence and teaching were in no way withheld from her, but her own mental attitude had rendered her to some extent unreceptive of them, although she herself was quite unconscious of this. A wealth of love, strength and knowledge lay at her hand, but her own ingratitude had sadly crippled her power to accept it. 2. High philosophic or scientific thought. This class does not include those philosophers who spend their time in verbal argument and hair-splitting, for that is a form of discussion which has its roots in selfishness and conceit, and can therefore never help towards a real understanding of the facts of the universe, not produce results that can work themselves out on the mental plane. We find here rather those noble and unselfish thinkers who seek insight and knowledge only for the purpose of enlightening and helping their fellows. A typical example was that of a later follower of the Neoplatonic system, who was occupied in unraveling the mysteries of that school of thought, and in endeavoring to understand its bearing upon human life and development. Another case was that of an astronomer whose studies had led him to pantheism. He was still pursuing his studies with reverence, and was gaining knowledge from those orders of devas, through whom on this plane the majestic cyclic movement of the stellar influences seems to express itself in ever-changing coruscations of living light. He was lost in contemplation of a vast panorama of whirling nebulae and gradually forming systems and worlds, and striving to form some idea of the shape of the universe. His thoughts surrounded him, shaped as stars, and he listened with joy to the stately rhythm of the music that pealed out in mighty chorales from the moving orbs. Scientists such as this astronomer would return to Earth, as great discoverers, with unerring intuitions of the mysterious ways of nature. 3. Literary or artistic effort exercised unselfishly. On this level I found our greatest musicians. Mozart, Beethoven, Bach, Wagner and others are still flooding the heaven world with harmony far more glorious than they were able to produce when on earth. Streams of divine music pour into them from the higher regions, to be specialized by them and made their own, and then to be sent forth through all the plain in a tide of melody which adds to the bliss of all around. Both those who are functioning in full consciousness on this plane, and disembodied entities at this level, each of whom is wrapped up in his own thought cloud, are deeply affected by the ennobling influence of this music. Painters and sculptors are here constantly making, by their thought, artificial elementals in all kinds of lovely forms, which they send forth for the delight and encouragement of their fellow men. These beautiful conceptions may also in many cases be grasped by the minds of artists still in the flesh, acting as inspirations to them. An interesting figure seen on this level was that of a chorister who had died young. He had little save the one great gift of song, but he had used the gift worthily, trying to be the voice of the people to heaven, and of heaven to the people, and ever longing to know more music, and render it more worthily, for the church's sake. In his heaven life his wish was bearing fruit, and over him was bending the quaint angular figure of Street Cecilia, formed by his thought of the picture of her in a stained glass window. This thought form was vivified by one of the archangels of the celestial hierarchy of song, and through it he taught the chorister a grander strain of music than ever earth has known. Another example was that of a man who had on earth refused to use his literary power merely to earn a living for himself, but had instead written a book which none would read. He had been alone all his life, and eventually died of sorrow and starvation. In his heaven life he was also in solitude, but he saw stretching before him the utopia of which he had dreamed, and the vast impersonal multitudes whom he had longed to serve. The joy of their joy surged back to him and made his solitude a heaven. 4. Service for the sake of service. On this level I found many who have rendered service for the sake of service, rather than because they desired to please any particular deity. They are engaged in working out with full knowledge and calm wisdom, vast schemes of beneficence, magnificent plans of world improvement, and at the same time they are maturing powers with which to carry them out in the future on the lower plane of physical life. Chapter 27 The Mental Plane. It is the function of mental matter to vibrate in response to the modes of the spirit working as intellect, just as astral matter plays a similar part for desire and emotion, and as buddhic matter responds to the spirit working as intuition. Hence the mental plane is that part or aspect of nature which belongs to consciousness working as thought, not to mind working through the physical brain, but to mind working in its own world, unencumbered with physical matter. The five lower planes of nature correspond to the five elements of the ancients as follows.